Welcome back to another episode of The Political Life. Today, we come to you with a very special episode live from Washington, D.C., from the Willard Hotel, the Washington Area State Relations Group, known as WASHRAG, headed up by Maggie Mick from Multistate, put on their first live event since COVID. They had two panel discussions, and I was lucky enough to get to moderate one of the panels. Which when you have five great guests like I did, it makes my job pretty easy, to put it mildly. So a shout out to Maggie and Robin from Focus for organizing this event. They did a great job. It was a big turnout, and they're going to start having more in-person events. I think they have their holiday party coming up in December, and they'll have many more events in person in 2023. So we're looking forward to that. So the panel was really fantastic. It was, like I said, it was five people. It was John Holub from New Jersey, Chris Hosek from Texas, Peter Ruddle from Michigan, Sarah Mercer from Colorado, and Brian Bautista from Florida. And Maggie did a great job picking very interesting states. We hear about the elections, and we hear about what they expect from the in the coming year. And so it really is, it was nice to be in person. So I hope you enjoy it. And here you go.
So upon the onset of COVID-19, WASHRAG launched its Inside the Dome series, where we host virtual briefings with state councils who share the latest policy and political developments in their states. While our plans were made pre-pandemic, the timing of this new offering could not have been more pressing. At WASHRAG, we seek to leverage our networks and relationships and knowledge, hopefully you'll get some answers from your colleagues here, to the benefit and betterment of our colleagues. And Inside the Dome is a fine representation of those principles. Now, speaking of timing, today we will examine a political landscape that is fraught with change and uncertainties. We have unanswered questions from last week's elections, awaiting outcomes in Nevada, Alaska, and New Hampshire. Granted, I wrote this morning, so that could have changed. And we have also have larger national and global questions that will impact our work. Will we see a recession in 2023? What will Carrie Lake do next? As of this morning, there are 17 Democratic trifectas, last week flipping four of the 88 chambers, and Republicans hold 21. Regardless of how the remaining results fall, this will be the record number of state trifectas. Incumbents dominated the 36 gubernatorial races on Tuesday. Nevada's Governor Silsack is the only incumbent who lost their seat. Democrats picked up seats in Maryland, Massachusetts, Arizona, while GOP flipped Nevada. And I am thrilled to say that in 2023, we will have a record number of women governors. Now, before the election, we were expecting to see at least 24 states with legislative leadership change due to retirement, term limits, or primary loss. Since Tuesday, that number has only increased. These leaders play key roles in determining the viability of hundreds of thousands of bills becoming law each legislative session. Leaders utilize political maneuvers and parliamentary procedure to shape the legislative debate in their chamber. For most jurisdictions, they are the epicenter of power in their chamber and state. Building positive relationships with these leaders can be critical to ensuring legislative success for years to come. Our goal for today's program was to put together conversations that focused on states with forecasted leadership change to occur: Michigan, Colorado, Florida. We identified New Jersey as just going through massive change in 2021. And then there's always Texas, because Chris was also able to join us. Now, we also invited legislative leaders with some semblance of forecasted stability next year: Maryland, North Carolina, Massachusetts, and Virginia. And we are honored to be joined by President Ferguson, Leader Kilgore, Chairman Sain, and Assistant Majority Leader DiDomenico today. Now, to lead our conversations, we have Jim O'Brien with The Political Life and David Atkins, CEO and Executive Director for the Council of State Governments. These are two of the most curious minds in politics, with Jim interviewing leading politicos each week for his podcast By Night and pounding Hartford's political pavement by day, and David, who has spent a lifetime both studying and serving the states, its institutions, and those that govern them. We are grateful to them for being here. Now, with that said, I'm going to welcome Jim and our first set of panelists to the stage, and I'll turn it over to Jim to quickly introduce them or just start the conversation.
Come on up. Thanks. I just want to take a, it's nice to be back in person, and let's, Maggie and Robin have put in a tremendous amount of work and just done a great job, and Maggie and Robin, thank you for getting us back together. It's been great. So there's one other, we are recording this, this part as a podcast. The panelists have been warned. So if you stand up and start yelling questions, you you know, you may be recorded. We can always edit it out. I have a feeling that Pierce Haley will be getting a lot of phone calls about Taylor Swift tickets. People are going to want to know about that. But since we already did a somewhat of a brief intro, if when I ask you a question, if you want to tell us a little bit more about your firm, we can. I thought I would talk to ask Sarah the first question. You on one of our pre-calls, you mentioned the ballot initiatives in Colorado, and I saw that the ballot initiative with psychedelics passed. I think it was kind of close, but it passed. And so Colorado, they were on the kind of the leader in legalizing marijuana and cannabis, and now they are taking the lead on this. Can you tell us a little bit about the ballot initiative and psychedelics?
Yeah, it's thank you so much, and thank you for having us. This is such a just a great panel. I'm really interested to hear this conversation, and as I mentioned, to hear about the trends that we're seeing across the states. Yeah, I think, you know, Colorado, we have now legalized marijuana, cannabis. We have legalized sports betting and now magic mushrooms. You know, it's really interesting. The strategy of the campaign on psychedelics has been very similar to what we saw with cannabis, which is get a foot in the door with medical use, and then likely look for an opportunity to open the door to full commercialization. And I think one of the big lessons learned in Colorado from the cannabis space has been that there is a difference between decriminalization, legalization, and commercialization. And voters don't quite appreciate the nuance in that. So we're gonna have to wait and see, you know, what happens. But with regard to the psychedelics, you know, it's gonna, when it gets online, it'll be sort of, you know, centers that where there is an overseeing of individuals who are taking these psychedelic plants and mushrooms for medical purposes. And then also individuals can now grow them in their home and share them, but cannot sell them. But I think it probably won't be long till we see another measure to fully commercialize it. Interestingly enough, on our ballot, we also had a collection of three measures to liberalize and really modernize, I think more than anything, laws around alcohol. And even the voters are like, thumbs up on cannabis, thumbs up on mushrooms. You know, making it easier to get alcohol delivered to your home? Absolutely not. So I don't know.
Oh, it went down?
It went down in flames.
Oh, wow.
And the measure to allow wine in grocery stores is basically 50-50. It might go to a recount. So
incredible.
Really interesting juxtaposition in the minds of voters in Colorado.
So psychedelics may be coming to a state near you.
Yeah.
So stay tuned. And your governor is, you know, he doesn't get a lot of press, but he is incredibly popular in Colorado.
Yeah, very much so. You know, he has broad support from Coloradans around how he handled the pandemic. And his libertarian streak, I guess, or the libertarian component of his ideology has really come through to voters. So, you know, at the same time that he has been very deliberately over his first term erecting a very significant climate change scaffolding in Colorado, which has included things like the electrification of everything, green building codes, delivery fee to support transportation, retail like delivery fee, and then also including in now the assessment of when we're doing transportation infrastructure, really moving away from building new roads So on the one hand, he has that very, very liberal side. He comes out and supports a ballot measure to reduce the state income tax. So from a fiscal perspective, he's much more conservative, and voters seem to really like that a lot, in addition to how he handled the pandemic, which was really about taking individual and personal responsibility, even though, of course, Colorado did have some shutdowns and our schools were shut down for a while. But he really moved quite quickly to individual responsibility, and that's really resonated with voters.
And the tax reduction that passed also?
It did, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, another juxtaposition in how Colorado voters voted on these ballot measures. They voted to reduce the state income tax while at the same time dedicating a certain amount of state of income tax revenue to affordable housing, and then also imposing a new tax or an increase of income tax on our quote-unquote high-income earners to have free lunches for all children in Colorado.
Incredible. Well, if I don't go down to the end to Brian at the Southern Strategy Group and ask about the question that everyone may have on their mind, you have a governor down there. I can't quite remember his name. And he had a press conference yesterday right before the former President Trump made his announcement that he will be running for a third time. Tell us a little bit about things in Florida, the election. I mean, it's really incredible. You know, if you think about it, the red wave was really tampered by the Democrats, whether it was Dobbs and whether it was other issues. But in Florida, I mean, he won by, I think, 20 points, and he didn't beat a nobody. I mean, Charlie Crist is not some, you know, just run-of-the-mill person. Really, the numbers he put up in Miami-Dade County, incredible. Tell us a little bit about what your thinking is about Governor DeSantis in Florida.
Yeah. So Brian Battista with the Southern Group in Florida. And it's hard to overstate how impressive DeSantis's victory in Florida was. You mentioned 20 points. This is an office that the last three elections was decided by 1 point or less, right? Including DeSantis's last run, decided by 1 point. And so for him to come out 4 years later and win by 20 points is absolutely unheard of. I mean, it is a resounding victory. And Charlie Crist, you mentioned, you know, now has the dubious honor of being the only elected official in Florida to lose a statewide election as a Democrat, independent, and Republican. Right? So you're right. He's a very distinguished politician in that way. You know, what is DeSantis going to do? I don't own a farm, right? If I owned a farm, I'd be betting it on him running for president. So, I mean, the timing for him is right. He's got the momentum. I think it fits where the party is right now. There's always going to be obstacles running for president, right? I mean, it's never, ask Jeb Bush, right? Like, it doesn't ever just lay down in front of you to run. And I think that, you know, he and the people around him recognize that. So I think you can expect that we'll have a Florida man on Florida man showdown coming here. And it really started in earnest last night. He's building his whole ethos for this campaign around the idea of being a fighter. And so you can expect, I mean, he's going to take a fight to Trump, and Trump is not one to shy away from a fight. So, I mean, it's going to get nasty and pretty quick.
Boy, there was no hesitation in your answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely not. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Yeah. And then tell us a little bit about the mayor of Miami gets quite a lot of recognition and credit. And Miami has really changed a lot over the past 5 or 10 years. He's really kind of an up-and-coming star on the political scene.
Yeah, he's done an incredible job of really marketing and promoting Miami, you know, through Twitter and Instagram and things like that. And it's interesting. I mean, he is a very, very different type of Republican than Ron DeSantis, right? And so, I mean, you know, it's different sort of approaches. He's certainly created, you know, turned Miami into really the center of crypto and technology. We call South Beach Silicon Beach now.
Well, it's it's really becoming kind of the tech center of even being out Silicon Valley. Why don't we move to your right, Peter? Give us your incumbent governor won and is also a star in the Democratic Party. Tell us a little bit about the election, and you can tell us a little bit about your firm and the election in Michigan.
Great, thanks. My name's Peter Riddell. I'm with the Detroit-based law firm of Honigman. We're a Midwest-based firm, and I manage our government relations practice just in the state of Michigan. Governor Whitmer was overwhelmingly reelected. That's the obvious, right? The abortion issue and the Dobbs decision really was part one of her strategy. Part two of her strategy was just to run against Donald Trump. And the Republicans did their best to try to have someone who was catering to Donald Trump. And he eventually did endorse the Republican nominee, Tudor Dixon, who was abandoned by the party and left on her own devices. So the governor had a fantastic reelection. She has done everything right leading up to the election. She, right, I think we'll talk about it probably in a little bit, but was able to, with her coattails and some of the other things that were going on in Macomb County, the home of Reagan Democrats, able to bring the state House and the state Senate into the majority. That's the sixth time, this will be the sixth year since the Republican Party was formed under the Oaks in Jackson, Michigan, that the Democrats will have controlled everything in our state. So it's going to be a great launching pad for her should she choose national ambitions. Right, this morning she announced she is not running for president under any circumstances whatsoever, so I think that means she is. But having said that, right, she's going to be incredibly loyal to the president and is not going to make any overt actions until he has finalized his plans, whatever they may be.
Thank you. All right, let's move on to Texas. Chris, when I was looking at your bio, you were chair of the Railroad Commission, correct?
Well, I was the chief of staff.
Chief of staff for the chair of the Railroad Commission.
Promoted me, and I appreciate
it. Well, that's all right. That's what we're here for.
Right. So
tell us a little bit about the Railroad Commission.
Right, yeah, and I should clarify, the Railroad Commission has nothing to do with railroads. Only in Texas would you have a commission named Railroad Commission. It's the Oil and Gas Commission. But so we regulate all oil and gas in Texas, and obviously we're the largest producer in the nation. If you were to carve us out, we'd probably be the third largest producer in the world. So produce a lot of oil and gas there. But when we look at our state, Governor Abbott won pretty significantly, facing a significant challenge against Beto O'Rourke, right? So you mentioned this about Charlie Crist, and it just dawned on me that Beto O'Rourke's the first candidate ever to lose a U.S. Senate seat, a presidency, and a governorship in Texas. So, and when you look at these numbers, they're really stark. So 4 years ago, Lupe Valdez challenged Greg Abbott, spent about $20 million and lost by about 12 points. This year, Beto O'Rourke spent $120 million and lost by 12 points. So Texas looks still pretty significant, a Republican state. Both chambers are controlled by Republicans. I think what's really interesting politically, if you were to look at Texas, is what we call the Valley and what's going on down there. We've seen kind of a significant shift from Democrat to Republican. Two House seats were won by Republicans in the Valley by Hispanic candidates. And one Senate seat almost flipped there. So we have super majorities in each chamber, 86 in the House. Our speaker looks in a solid position to retain his speakership. But this session, we're going to be talking about a lot of oil and gas in Texas. So
that little small business that you had oversight of.
That's right.
But I love the name. And also, and you're correct, we shouldn't overlook the size of his victory in Texas. Really incredible. All right, let's move on to New Jersey. Tell us about election-wise in New Jersey. What's the latest? How did things fare?
I always say Jersey's an odd state for a lot of reasons, but in particular, we're odd year elections. So Jersey, and I believe Virginia is the other state that has odd year elections. So
right.
we're dealing with legislative races this year.
Been quiet.
It's going to be heating up for us in 2023. And it's going to be really interesting year because last year we had a pretty big seismic shift. It might have been the precursor to the everybody thinking there was going to be a red wave, because in Jersey we actually had maybe a red ripple. Republicans actually picked up six seats in our General Assembly, and our Senate president was actually knocked out, which was just shocking. I can't even characterize it. That's not even the right word to use it. This is a Senate president who 2 years earlier fended off a challenge that the teachers union hated him, and they actually spent $10 million to try and knock him off and barely scratched him. And then fast forward 2 years later, which was last year, and he lost to a relatively no-name trucker. He drives a truck for Raymore Flanigan.
Is this the one who had the ad on the motorcycle?
Yep.
Yeah.
And he had spent no money. I mean, I didn't even know how much the Senate president outspent him. It was astronomical. So it was pretty shocking. So we now have, and I will say, and people, some people are surprised, political bossism is still strong in New Jersey, and there's a divide between North Jersey and South Jersey. Very strong political boss, and was having the Senate president based in South Jersey no longer, losing that seat, has really kind of changed some of the political dynamics between the North and the South, and power has shifted farther north now. And we have a new Senate president who, which is interesting enough, he kind of has really scaled back how many times the committees meet. He's really scaled back agendas. So it's going to be interesting to see going forward. He's still kind of, I think, figuring out how to do everything, but it's definitely, things have changed procedurally. Hopefully not as many bad bills are going to be coming up over, you know, we're always playing defense 9 times out of 10. So it's going to be interesting how it plays into the Republicans are energized in New Jersey. I actually was just you got me out of going to Second Night in Atlantic City tonight. There's a big conference, the League of Municipalities, and I went to two parties last night. I've never seen more Republicans in a room. They were just very energized. They feel they can pick up some more seats next year. Remains to be seen. I think the map, the way the districts have been drawn, it makes it very difficult for them. But they could potentially, there's a couple areas. I don't think they could get control, but I think they could come a lot closer. So it could be interesting. I mean, it's going to be just because of what happened last year. I think anything's possible next year now. So
yeah, that's the Senate president is just an incredible. And when I saw that ad, the clip of the ad after it was just really amazing. All right, with this group, I don't know how much time we have left. I will get the wave, but I am sure that people have questions. And so, if anyone out there would like to ask a question, you can simply stand up. Robin has a microphone; she can run around. But does anyone in the audience have a question they'd like to ask? I'll jump into my next one, and you can be thinking and jump up if you have a question. So does anybody have any follow-up to anything they heard from their colleagues that was just said?
I think in Colorado, something that was very interesting, Colorado really broke blue. In quite a surprise, actually, to where I think voters are. We had our first ever open primaries, and in that effort, voters chose more moderate Republican candidates over the more Trump-style candidates, overwhelmingly. So we had an unbelievable group of Republican candidates. We just redrew our maps. We have an independent redistricting commission that made the seats more competitive. And the Republicans won none. They lost the seats that they had where it was competitive, and then they won zero of the competitive races. So we have now seen Colorado really move in that blue direction, and it was quite a surprise because we're a majority unaffiliated voter state, and I was really interested to see, you know, if a voter who, take our Secretary of State race, for example, if a voter chose, is unaffiliated and chose to vote in the Republican primaries and chose our more moderate candidate, Pam Anderson, over the more Trump-style candidate, would that voter then in the general election, if they had already voted for Pam Anderson, decide that they were going to vote for the Democrat, Jenna Griswold? And that looks like that's what happened. And it's really interesting to see that change in voter behavior as we're starting to open up primaries, that voters may make those choices. They may make those strategic choices in the primary and then make different candidate choices across the party line. Mm-hmm. So we certainly need more elections to see any trends and to see how that might play out. But that was something that really surprised me in Colorado. And I think that it may be easy to look at where Colorado is and say, oh, Colorado is sort of the new California, given where everything has moved. But I don't know about that. I think we're going to need to really see where voters go. And it does seem that voters are choosing candidates over parties more in Colorado.
Well, it's interesting. In the state of Connecticut, in Greenwich, Connecticut, we had two or three Democratic state reps that were elected for the first time in maybe over 100 years. And so you're seeing in places like Connecticut and suburban New Jersey and New York, the suburbs that used to be solid Republican are now turning blue. And it's really a sea change. Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, just the exact opposite effect in Florida, right? I mean, Miami-Dade went Republican for the first time in very long. I think there were four counties in Florida that voted for Charlie Crist on balance, right, out of 67 counties. I mean, it's just incredible. If you look at and it can't all be explained by this, right? There were incredible tailwinds because DeSantis is extremely popular in the state. It's interesting, right? Like, he almost feels like he's a personality trait to people from Florida now, right? I mean, Floridians identify so much with the governor right now, and he's so popular. But if you look at the net migration since COVID, I think it's something like 2-to-1 odds that people who moved to Florida were Republican, right? And they're all coming out of the Northeast, right? So they're leaving. It's maybe some of those same people from the suburbs of New York, New Jersey, Wisconsin, right, are opting into basically DeSantis land, right, and moving into Florida. And that, I think, has a lot to do with the election results you saw in Florida.
Yeah, the change is just, it's amazing. We have a question from the audience? Yes?
I'll never forget you saying, don't Fauci my Florida. We were talking about a year ago. Yeah. So it really is. It's a mental mind state. So a Florida question and a New Jersey question. First, in New Jersey, with new legislative leadership, it's a commuter capital. It's very hard to spend more than an afternoon there. How do you build relationships effectively with lawmakers in New Jersey, aside from hiring you? Just building
just
relationships. And then a Florida to Meredith's question, you know, we watched what happened with Disney last year, and there are a lot of corporations that are getting nervous about how to navigate the political waters and in not only Republican states, but states that are leaning really far left. So what would you impart as best practices or a do-over for Disney in Florida? So those are the two questions.
Start. Yeah, I mean, so as far as building relationships, you know, it is a part-time legislature, but they meet fairly regularly. They could be in Trenton 2 days a week. And the beauty, though, is we're such a small state. I mean, you could be anywhere in the state within 2 hours. Building relationships, you just got to get out to the districts. You got to meet with the legislators on their home turf. I think that's the easiest way. But they do meet fairly regularly in Trenton that you can also knock out on, you know, relationship building just in the state house and just kind of walking around. So it's not that much of a challenge. It really isn't.
And you can get to anywhere in the state in not much time.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
And you can't even cross Houston in 2 hours.
Yeah.
I've got to tell you, I'm jealous.
Yeah,
this is not specific to any company. I mean, it's been sort of an experience in Florida over the past few years for a lot of companies that have kind of gotten out there. And basically, the position of the current administration there is if you stick your head up out of the foxhole on an issue, you're liable to get hit, right? And so to the extent companies wade into these issues that the politicians care about, they're punching back, and it's really popular, right? I mean, DeSantis had some of his strongest fundraising numbers coming out of picking some of these corporate battles. So I think that trend is just going to continue, you know, to the extent, and it's difficult for companies, right? You know, they have their employees are their stakeholders, their customers are their stakeholders, and the nation in general, and so they want to take positions on some of these issues, but I'll just say, if you take a position, just know that you may become a target, especially if the government has the ability to affect your action in some way, right? If there's a high level of regulatory touch or some type of control like that, I think you're an even better target for them to take retribution on, and so I think we're just going to continue to see it given the popularity with some of his voter base on some of these issues.
This is such a fascinating issue for me because Republicans historically have been friends of the business community and have been corporations' friends and still are in some respects. But, when Governor DeSantis says in no uncertain terms that Florida is where woke comes to die, that is a message. I mean, he's putting down a marker to corporations to say, you better not put your head up at it, kind of pop your head up on these issues, or there will be consequences. And on the issue of ESG, I mean, this is absolutely something that we're going to see come up in its nuanced ways in each state, and we're going to see it on the Democrat side. Mm-hmm. We've already seen it in some ways, right? But we're going to continue to see it, I think, on the Democrat side, where there are basically mandates for ESGs, and then on the Republican side, where there are prohibitions on ESG issues. And how are businesses supposed to take a right step? Because in addition to having to navigate this incredibly complex on the political side of it, there's also the consumer and increasingly the employee side of it, where, you know, we have many clients whose employees are clamoring and demanding that their companies, that their employer take stands on certain issues. So how are businesses going to navigate this when they can't really take a right step? And I think that's going to be now also adding to the complexity, not just about governors and legislatures, but increasingly about attorneys general, right? So this is just something for everyone to keep an eye on. And the more that we can start to see what's going on across the country and maybe find ways to manage and navigate and share that information, the better off the entire business community is going to be.
Yeah, I mean, Florida is the incoming Speaker of the House. So Florida, I should add, is one of those states that has a supermajority in both the House and Senate now. We're calling it a super duper majority because, I mean, it's not even close. They have tons of extra seats. And the incoming Speaker of the House has made ESG one of his top priorities. And so, I mean, to your point, you got to kind of pick a lane, right? Because, I mean, if you're a fund, the New York pension fund won't invest in you unless you're ESG certified. Florida is about to pass a rule where Florida's SBA won't invest in you if you have ESG as a qualifying criteria at all. So you basically have to, you're just going to have to pick and choose who you want to work with. And it's, I mean, these are highly polarized times, and, you know, businesses, I think, are experiencing that.
And along that same vein, in Texas, last session, we passed a divestiture piece of legislation. So if you divest from fossil fuels, you can't do business in Texas, or you can't do business with the state of Texas. Excuse me. Make sure I said that.
Yeah.
Make sure the podcast has that.
Right. So, we'll edit that up.
Yeah, please edit, clean that up for a second. But, I mean, then, you know, you would normally think, well, you know, that's not big of a deal, that big of a deal, but we have some of the largest investment funds, you know, the Permanent University Fund, the Permanent School Fund in Texas. So these companies, you know, that had these grand ESG statements, moving away from fossil fuels, had to take a step back and say, wait a minute, let us show you how we are still investing in oil and gas. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of an interesting turn of events that Texas did when we passed that piece of legislation.
And
I think you probably see that in other states.
Yeah. I mean, we're absolutely going to see that. And that's kind of my point of, you know, if you have a high regulatory touch, if the government, you know, has the ability to, you know, like that, I think that's more and more where you're going to see it. They're going to use kind of the levers at their control to push people around.
And the super duper majority, that's a new definition in Robert's rules. You can, I like that. Sarah mentioned ESG, and I think Meredith, did you have a question?
Yeah, it's on even more controversial, but just taxes. Where do you see tax priorities being in your states next year? A lot of push to reduce taxes, a lot of taxes on high wealth individuals, some property taxes. I know that'll be key in Texas, but what's your state's flavor of tax policy heading into 2023?
John, why don't we start with you and just go down?
Well, Jersey is one of the most overtaxed states in the country, so it's always a big, big issue. And being an election year, you know, there'll be a lot of lip service of trying to cut taxes. Will they actually do anything at the end of the day is unlikely. We definitely won't see any increase in taxes, so I think that's the good thing, because we have had, you know, the corporate business tax has been raised recently, and I just don't see them. I see them avoiding taxes, at least for the next year.
Sarah?
Yeah, Colorado back in the 90s passed this really unique law. We're the only state that has it, where the people actually took the power to enact or increase any taxes from the legislature. So we never, ever see the legislature ever enact or increase taxes. But that doesn't mean that voters aren't deciding on that, as I mentioned in some of my earlier comments. So it really is going to be what voters want to do. So just like this session, we saw voters reduce the income tax, but also increase the income tax for high income earners. So it really will be to be determined about, we're just at the whim of what the voters want to do on taxes.
Yeah, we're going to have about a $30 billion surplus. So you're going to see a significant move to decrease property taxes in the state. How far it gets, that's a good question. But I think you'll see leadership move pretty hard on that. And we don't have a state income tax, so we wouldn't see anything like that.
So, right, remember, Michigan has not had Democratic control in a long, long time. So this is the start of a revenge tour, a 40-year revenge tour in Michigan. So, right, when Governor Schneider was elected, he started taxing public pensions. Governor Whitmer campaigned on repealing the pension tax. Most seniors thought that it applied to all of them, but it didn't. It just applies to public pension. The other two tax issues, I'm using tax in the broadest form here, but we really think that there's probably going to be some type of polluter pay legislation that the governor is going to propose. And the last thing is, right, the governor in her very first campaign campaigned on Fix the Damn Roads, right? She became the Fix the Damn Roads governor. Well, so much of our transportation fund is reliant on the gasoline tax. So we expect an EV fee to be something that comes out in the first 6 months of next year.
Yeah, Florida tax is a four-letter word in Florida, right? So we'll be they'll certainly look to cut taxes as they can. Some specific areas. I think you'll see coming out of the storm some property tax abatement stuff for some of the storm damaged areas. In affordable housing. Affordable housing is a massive issue in Florida, as it is, you know, most places in the country. That's a huge priority of the Senate president. I think you'll see them try to use property tax as an incentive to keep housing affordable and turn more housing affordable, right? So using that to encourage workforce and affordable housing. And then also, and this is for Home Depot back there, sales tax relief on building materials to try to encourage more building. I think you can see something like that. But yeah, I mean, the general trend in Florida is going to be for less taxes.
With that, why don't we wrap it up and give a big round of applause for the panel. Thank you very much. And we appreciate it and wish you all the best in your states.
Fantastic. Maggie and Robin, thank you very much. Really enjoyed it. Enjoyed being back in D.C., enjoyed being in person. Great to see so many friendly faces. And I hope you, the listeners, got a great feel for the different states, and you also enjoyed it. So we hope you all have a great and safe week, and we will see you next week. And remember, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, and you can sign up for our email at politicallife.net. See you in a week. All the best.